This month's show is dedicated to Y&T's bass player and founder member Phil Kennamore, who tragically lost his battle with lung cancer on January the 7th of this year. He was just 57.
This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix, right here, right now.
Yep, this one's for the Phils, both Kennamore and Lynott, who died 25 years earlier almost to the day. And we feature the new Thin Lizzy lineup and talk to frontman Ricky Warwick about taking that job on.
I never for one moment didn't think that I couldn't do this. It never felt uncomfortable. It always felt like it was the right thing to be doing. I just thought, this is one of my all-time favourite bands, and I'm getting the chance to sing for them. I want to make sure that I do the best that I can and I'm doing a damn good job.
Next up is Europe, who've released three albums since their comeback 6 years ago and are now re-established as a band with a somewhat harder, more mature sound. But when talking to frontman Joey Tempest, the subject of what sent them stratospheric back in the day is unavoidable.
Outside Stockholm, we were kids dreaming of touring the US and the UK, and thanks to our third album, which really opened things, Final Countdown, we got to do it, and we got to do the whole thing, you know, and it's amazing.
Rebooted 80s originals Tokyo Blade have a new album due out, and founder member Andy Bolton lays out the cold, hard truth about his chosen profession.
We said to the manager, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to survive? How are we going to eat? He said, right, you've got a box of t-shirts here. That's your money. That's your money for everything. That's your money for your diesel, for your food, for everything. You know, you sell them and you live. And if you don't, you don't.
We also talked to Chris Zangarides, legendary producer of Thin Lizzy, Ozzy, Priest, and now Tokyo Blade, among many others, about his war stories and the continuing importance of a producer, even in these days of DIY album making. Finally, we'll hear from Ronnie James Dio's cousin and Rod's frontman, Dave Rock Feinstein, about his recent solo album, Bitten by the Beast, which features one of Ronnie's last ever recordings. Plus, of course, we've got the news roundup, new releases and tour information. and Phil Lynott there with Out in the Fields, a track which we had, of course, already chosen as our opener for the show. But astonishingly, as we were mixing the final edit on February the 6th, we learnt that Gary himself has sadly passed away in his sleep, we think, while on holiday in Spain. Gary was just 58 and healthy, as far as we know, so it's a huge shock to hear that. He was an amazing talent across a range of styles, and he will be sorely missed.
Classic rock and metal news.
Motley Crue singer Vince Neil will spend 2 weeks in jail this month after pleading guilty to a drink driving charge. Neil said, "I have recognised that you cannot drink and drive at all. I take full responsibility for my actions and will learn from this experience." It's a shame he didn't learn from it in 1984 when he was sentenced to 30 days in jail for driving under the influence, resulting in a car wreck which took the life of Hanoi Rocks drummer Nicholas Razzle Dingley. Eddie Van Halen's former wife, actress Valerie Bertinelli, recently remarried, and guest of honour was none other than the cheeky chap himself, and she stressed the importance of getting along, saying, "I think it's really important that you should never hate your ex more than love your children, and I've never hated Ed, so I'm lucky." Status quo's Francis Rossi has had to cancel his scheduled solo tour of the UK this month, requiring urgent surgery for a hernia complaint. Get well soon, fella. Jack Bruce, founder member of Cream, of course, laid into Simon Cowell this month, verbally of course, saying he should be exterminated. In an interview with Uncut magazine, he went on to say, "You can pretty much guarantee that had that bastard Cowell been around at the beginning of the 60s, he'd have stopped it all from happening. Bob Dylan, sing in tune and stop whining, you big-nosed bastard. No, he's a human fire blanket, a vile individual." Well said, Jack. Alice Cooper was baffled in a recent interview when he was told that Robert Plant had confessed that he may be too old to perform Led Zeppelin songs. "I go out on stage and say, turn it up," Cooper said. "I never get tired of playing my songs." He went on to say, "They're just standing there. What's so hard? Jimmy Page wants to do it. John Paul Jones wants to do it. And they got John Bonham's son, who's a killer drummer. All they need is Robert Plant. But what's Robert Plant out there doing? Playing folk music. What is he doing?" Veteran DJ Paul Gambaccini declared that it was the end of the rock era in the Guardian newspaper recently, in the same way that the jazz era was over. He was basing his conclusion on recent statistics that the percentage of rock songs in the singles chart had dropped from 13% in 2009 to 3% in 2010. But as any fool knows, rock has never been a single genre anyway, and in fact, January, Nielsen SoundScan reported that 27% of all digital downloads are down to rock bands, as opposed to 25% for pop and only 22% for hip-hop. Expect that one to run and run. It's just over 25 years since Thin Lizzy's charismatic songwriter and frontman Phil Lynott passed away, and since then the band has toured in various guises with assorted former members. In 2009 they were given the support slot for three of AC/DC's shows, but then had to cancel sadly due to an injury to drummer Tommy Aldridge and the subsequent departure of vocalist and guitarist John Sykes. With the band looking for all the world like a spent force, classic Lynott member Scott Gorham decided not just to keep going but to add a few twists. Back came original drummer Brian Downey and keyboardist Darren Wharton, who of course has been fronting Dare since 1989. Bass duties were handed to the much respected Marco Mendoza, with the all-important second guitar slot filled by none other than former Dio and current Def Leppard axe hero Vivian Campbell. But who would sing for the new lineup? Enter former almighty frontman Ricky Warwick, who's been enjoying a very fruitful solo career for the past few years. A seemingly odd choice, but as we all discovered during Lizzie's recent tour of the UK, there was reason in Gorham's apparent madness, as Ricky took time out to explain. Apologies in advance for the audio on this segment. If it sounds like we were talking in a toilet underground somewhere, it's because we were.
I've known Scott for almost 20 years. Scott played my first solo record, played guitar on my first solo record. So he knows how I sound, he knows me as a friend. And Scott just said, "Look, you know, we're putting the band back together. It's a really strong fan. Brian's back in the band for the first time in years. We really want you to sing. You know, I think you can do this." And I talked to Scott and I asked him what he expected from me. And he told me what his vision was and what he wanted to do with the band. And it just sounded fantastic. And I said, "I'm in." I knew that it would take a lot of hard work, and I knew I was quite prepared to put the hard work in, but it never felt uncomfortable. Most people always follow my gut. That's not to say I wasn't nervous or anything like that, of course I was, but I just thought, this is one of my all-time favourite bands, I'm getting the chance to sing for them, I want to make sure that I do the best that I can and do a damn good job. And first and foremost for Phil, and for the guys in the band, and then obviously for the fans. And you know, 6 months I listened to nothing but Thin Lizzy, you know, as much as I could. It was everywhere. I'd get up, get the kids off to school, Thin Lizzy would go on 6-7 hours a day, and I'd stand there and just listen to Phil's phrasing and all his little philisms, as I like to call them, in the songs, and make sure I was getting them down, you know.
I understand in terms of validation, if you needed anything, Bristol was a quite an important show.
It was huge. It was really emotional. It was really brilliant that Phil's widow Caroline came down, and his daughter Kathleen, and they came back after the show, and they were gushing, and they'd been up dancing the whole show, and they just gave me the best validation that I could get, you know, basically saying that, you know, that Phil was approved, and that for me was that was the icing on the cake. That was something I was very nervous about them being there. I really wanted them to love it. I really, really did, and they did, and you know, so I, you know, grin like a Cheshire Cat for the rest of the evening.
You could imagine. Did you have any opinions on bands getting back together with key personnel missing before this?
Well, you know, I do and I don't. And I think it depends how it's done. I think if it's just half-assed and people are just trying to make a quick buck and cash in, then it's horrible. But I think if people are putting their heart and soul into it and it's done for the right reasons, and everybody still strongly believes in the material and what the band stood for, then I think it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, listen, let's be honest here, Thin Lizzy will always be Phil, and that's it. We all know that, and nobody is going to try and change that. I would dream of changing that. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't take these songs forward and play them to a whole new generation of people and the diehard Lizzy fans as well, mm-hmm. and move the whole thing forward. I mean, like I said, if it's done with integrity and honour, then why not?
So how did you approach, I know we talked about it a little bit, but was there a specific approach that you took and how much Phil are we getting and how much Ricky are we getting?
I kind of thought, what would I, if I was going to see Thin Lizzy, I would want to see something as damn near close to the original as you could possibly get without Phil actually being there on stage. So I wanted to get all Phil's phrasing in the right place, like I said before, all his little ad-libs. His vocal range, Phil's vocal range and my vocal range are similar, which is great, so there's no notes that I couldn't hit or anything like that. And just try and get it. So yes, it does sound a little bit like Phil, but it's Ricky Warwick singing, so you've got the spirit of Philip Lynott there, but it's me singing his songs. But everything's in the right place. I don't want to change anything or say, well, I'll put my own little slant on that. No way. I mean, I'm a Thin Lizzy fan. I want to hear the songs the way we know and love them. Mm-hmm. So I was trying my hardest to get them as close to that as possible. Mm. And that meant, you know, just listening, singing along with Phil, doing the karaoke thing for hours and at home, you know, putting the Lizzy records on and getting the mic and just standing there and singing along with the songs that I had to learn for the tours.
Is it tempting to have looked at how well this lineup was gelled, mm-hmm. and look at the fact that your writing was influenced by Phil's writing, mm-hmm. to think, what about another record then? Because you could write songs,
sure.
as you know,
you're getting into very shaky territory there. Yes, I think it would be, I would love to do that, but I think it's ultimately Scott and Brian and Darren's call and everybody else and Phil's estate if that happens. And I would like to think if it did, it wouldn't be until we've done maybe a year, 18 months of just re-establishing the band and getting back on the road. But certainly with who you've got in the band, you've got amazing talented musicians and everybody's a songwriter, so something pretty good come up, but it would need to be amazing. You couldn't just make a good rock and roll record. It would need to blow people's minds and it would have to be that good. But you know, I'm sure we can start off with a song and see what happens, who knows.
So if you were being completely honest,
yeah.
What would the next 5 years look like musically?
If I could have my way and the way I would like it to go personally, I would like to see the Lizzy thing continue for as long as Scott and Brian enjoy doing it. And if that's another 3 or 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, that's great. I'd be happy just doing that and continuing my solo stuff alongside that.
And if you missed Thin Lizzy on the recent tour, you missed a treat. But don't panic, because you can catch them at Download in June. In the meantime, thanks to their wonderful management team, we can exclusively bring you a taster of what to expect with the classic Thin Lizzy track Bad Reputation, performed this January by the new lineup at the legendary Hammersmith Apollo, or Odeon as we prefer to call it. Enjoy.
That's the word out on the town. It gives a certain fascination, but it can only bring you down. You better turn yourself around. Turn yourself around. Turn it upside down. Turn yourself around. Well, that's tough love. You play too hard, too much real stuff. You're too sly. So bad reputation has made you old.
That's what it sounds like when you put a group of musicians together who've been playing live for an average of 30 odd years each and give them songs as brilliant as Thin Lizzy's to perform. Grammy nominated producer Chris Tsangarides worked extensively with Thin Lizzy, and in a fantastic interview which we'll include in more depth next month, he talks about that experience and why a good producer is still essential.
Sometimes it would be a Gary Moore solo record that we were doing. The next day would be a Phil Lynott solo, then it would be a Thin Lizzy, then it would be a Gary Moore again. And it was just seemed to be going on for years. And that was brilliant because they were terrific. I had to give Phil big thanks for actually turning round one day and saying, I'm thinking, you know, would you like to produce Thin Lizzy? And I looked in my diary and said, well, I'm free for the next 40 years, so that shouldn't be a problem. I couldn't believe it. I was like this kid, and one of my favourite bands has said, come and produce it. And I thought, well, what do I do? And I thought, well, I'm a fan. So as a fan, do I like this? Yes, no, whatever, and make it sound like I would want it to be.
Wow.
And that's the best bloody way of doing it, you know, because if you're not a fan of it, well, what are you doing? It just becomes a job that, yeah, well, record it any old how and who cares. But when you do care about it, that's when you get the best results, I think. Many of the smaller record companies are guilty of this as well. It's to give a rock band a couple of grand and go off and buy a computer and do it on that. And, well, with respect, they all sound the same. They're no way up to scratch, because you can't suddenly be a recording engineer, a producer, you know, a band, just like that. You know, you do need all these people.
As I said, there's more of that in next month's show when Chris talks about how he started out, why record companies should still be investing in new talent, and of course working with Anvil and that incredible documentary that was shot in part while he was producing their This Is 13 album. For some, in and out of the rock community, the mere mention of the band Europe can instill facial contortions, groans, and almost always an impression of playing twiddly keyboards to that song. But those who looked deeper at their catalogue were rewarded with many gems before and after the final Countdown album that took them to number one in 25 countries. The two records that followed, Out of This World and Prisoners in Paradise, were better in most people's opinion, but didn't fare as well, and the onset of the 90s and new styles of metal put paid to any more. Until 2004, that is, when they decided to show us what we'd been missing and released Start From the Dark, ushering in a new, more modern sound and a progression in style which encompassed their more recent influences. This was a harder, grittier sound, and 2006's Secret Society went even darker. Poodle rock this was not. 2009 saw the completion of their return and perhaps reinvention with the phenomenal Last Look at Eden album, which for me is the best of the lot. Their transition from 80s rock to a band for now was complete, rubber stamped by their hugely controversial appointment as headliners for the utterly heavy metal oriented Bloodstock Festival that year. They're headlining a tour of the UK and Europe starting in March, and I was lucky enough to chat with Joey Tempest about their astonishing return to form, starting with that potentially disastrous Bloodstock show.
Yeah, that was a good experience for us. Of course, we did Hellfest in France a couple of months earlier, which was also a metal fest, and we realised that we came over quite well there as well, so we weren't that nervous, but we were a bit sort of intrigued by all the discussions about Europe headlining Bloodstock. You know, it was people you know, that was very interested in it, and people that weren't interested at all in having us there. So after the fact that we played and it went well, it was really good for us because it sent a lot of ripples in the water, and it helped. UK is actually one of the countries that have understood what we've done the last three albums, that we actually are more of a relevant rock band these days and pushing limbs and doing new stuff and not just an 80s band. Some people are beginning to realize, hang on a second, this is it's not like the rest of them. This is something that's relevant now as well.
Certainly the last three albums since you guys came back, it's a grittier, it's a darker sound. I mean, are you happier with that? I mean, as opposed to the one that many people remember you for from the 80s, or isn't it really a preference?
It's not really a choice for us. It's just the journey we've been on. When we started with Start From The Dark, John came back with a more detuned guitar. He'd written a lot of solo albums, and he came back to the Bad Europe, and we have played, the other guys played with Glenn Hughes a little bit. I've done a lot of solo albums and moved on lyrically, so what happened with Start From The Dark was just organically where we were at the time. So we built from there. You know, Secret Society, we spent a lot of time being a bit nerdy with the sound and trying to get better at the technique and doing a good album that stood up in today's music world. And on Last Week at Eden, we used all our experience and just relaxed, really, and did an album that was more of a spontaneous rock album. That's why maybe it's done so well, but we said in 2003 when we had our meeting to start again that we're not going to copy what we did in the 80s. We're going to start anew and we're going to move on. It seems like the fans are joining us.
Yeah, I mean, you've described Last Look at Eden as Europe coming full circle and that it's a true classic rock album. Does that mean you kind of like the finished article? Is this Europe at its happiest?
It was. I mean, that was a spontaneous, fun recording, and we worked hard on it, but we had a new producer on board, Last Look at Eden was a pleasure, and it, maybe that's why people are taking it to heart and we're connecting with people. But also, it's got some, we didn't shy away from some old influences, and it's got some big guitars, big choruses, and we weren't censoring ourselves, you know. Let's do this one. This is a big chorus, but let's not shy away from it. Let's do it.
I heard somewhere that you didn't want to talk so much about the lyrics on Last Look at Eden and let people kind of paint their own pictures of it. Do you think that some of the mystery is lost these days because we can see and hear so many interviews with so many bands about how they recorded the album? In the old days, you might get one or two.
We weren't trying, but you have a point. The reason some of the lyrics were more subjects that wasn't, you know, I didn't really want to talk about like that. But I've talked about some of the lyrics. I mean, You in Love in Town, about my son, and also The Beast, about the whole Europe circus starting again. Last Look at Eden was started as a sort of, not political song or anything, but it was written just before, a few weeks before the election in America, where Obama won, and I was really worried that he wouldn't win. So it was Last Look at Eden. That was the idea there. But some of the songs that I've left, because it's kind of interesting to listen to it, and you sort of, I like that myself, to listen to lyrics, and what the hell is this about? It could be about that. I think it's about that, and it's kind of nice.
You were one of the first bands to be in the charts here. It's something that people remember, and there is a view that producers had helped that along, making the sound for all of those bands more radio-friendly, and in your case, it was Kevin Elson, obviously, with the
Fire. Yeah.
Now, with so many bands doing it themselves now, how important is a producer to you now?
I think the producer's very important still, extremely important still, because what you want when you have a band, you want the band to feel on their toes. You want the band to feel, we have a new guy we're working with. What's he going to sing? What's he going to bring to the table? You see, the band itself can get a little bit stale and a little bit sort of, if you don't bring fresh blood in, you may not progress as much. You may stay in your comfort zone. So in that sense, producers are really important, like they've always been.
Success in your homeland is always nice. I suppose it's the kind of first yardstick for bands. Success in Europe and Japan is, I guess, the next step. But the real yardstick is always the US. What are your memories of going top 10 in the States back in 87 with Final Countdown and that first the tour and that first headline show? I think it was the Warfield Theatre in San Francisco.
Yeah, I remember that one. Motley Crue guys came backstage just before the gig. I remember that now. It was amazing because we had American management, same management for Journey and Mr. Big, and it was a great period. We were, for the first time, we've reached, like you said, we reached the level to tour our own theater headline tour in America. I mean, for any band, for any kid, you would dream about that. But having said that, UK is as important to be able to get the tour in. That's what we always talk about in the band. And the result we've gotten in the UK for Last Look at Eden and our comeback is so amazing because it spills over to other countries through the press, through the hard rock press. And we're really grateful to have this connection with the UK again. But, of course, US, the first tour, I mean, amazing. And then we toured with Def Leppard in the US as well. When they were number one, we Pour Some Sugar on Me, we were special guests. I mean, that was amazing. So, yeah, we walked in outside Stockholm. We were kids dreaming of touring the US and the UK, and thanks to our third album, which really opened things, the Final Countdown, we got to do it, and we got to do the whole thing, you know, and it's amazing.
Now, I really wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask, but it's a question I've asked other bands who've had huge hits. I mean, obviously, Final Countdown was, I mean, in many ways, a diversion for Europe in terms of musical style, but obviously a really lucrative one. I mean, in hindsight, was it a blessing or a curse or a bit of both?
I think now, today, when all the time has passed, I think it's a great thing for the band. We still see it as an album track. It was written as such. It was 6.5 minutes long, and I think we brought it down a little bit, edited down a little bit in New York when we mastered it for a single. By then, people have decided to release it as a first single. That was also discussion. It was also discussion when we were in the studio about it, whether it should be, because it was so different, should it be on the album? And there was a lot of discussions around that song. But looking at it today, we love playing it loud. We don't listen to it at home. We don't see it in the shower or anything, but we love playing it loud. It's a great connection with the audience, explosion, and so that's not a problem. The song also invites new fans. They hear it, and they see that we tour, and then maybe they've only heard Final Countdown, and they realize, hang on, let me go and see that. And then they see the new album, they see hear other songs. So it has been known to bring in a lot of new people to us as well. So let's see, sometimes you can see it as a calling card, if you will. But no, we still love playing it live, and I think in the long run it's a blessing for us. It was written just as an album track. It was written as an opening. We needed, for our third album, we needed an opening for our show, something majestic, something that people will bring up people's expectations and bring everybody into the rock show that we had. And we started doing bigger shows on our third album, and that was the vehicle that we wanted to use, and that's why we put it there, and that it started to have a life on its own and become a classic hit or anything. We had no idea at all.
Now, I was watching the video for Rock the Night the other day, and you seemed to be singing into a ketchup bottle. What was that all about?
I think it was just a silly little... We had a little fun on that recording, I think. Young kids, we were in Hard Rock in Stockholm. We did two videos that day, I think, or those days. We had the English video team over in Stockholm. We had the American A&R guy was over. We did Carrie and Rock the Night in a few days there. Yeah, Rock Tonight, I don't remember in detail, but we tried to just muck about a little bit. I think it was the director as well, had some ideas, and we just had a lot of fun in that Hard Rock that day.
And as I said earlier, you can see Europe at various entertainment venues throughout the UK in February. All those dates are in our show notes, and no doubt the rest of the continent at some point during 2011. And to demonstrate what you may have been missing, here is the title track from the marvellous Last Look at Eden. We'll be right back. Tokyo Blade forms part of the new wave of British heavy metal alumni, producing a landmark debut album which was a definitive example of the early 80s heavy metal style. Like so many, though, with subsequent albums and tours, they were cursed with inadequate representation, predatory record companies, and plain bad luck, leaving them with literally no financial rewards for their efforts. Fast forward to 2011, and the original Blade lineup is back with a new lead singer, thanks in no small part to the tenacity of guitarist, songwriter, and founder member Andy Bolton. We talk through much of the band's history leading up to the recording of their first new album in 25 years, starting with his memories of that classic debut.
The whole thing really was a kind of a real labour of love from our point, and it did really well. It's much to our surprise, because actually when we got the first sort of white labels came through, we were really disappointed. You know, the sound wasn't good and it wasn't mixed properly, and we were very naive. We'd been told, oh, you know, don't worry about that, that'll be fixed in the mix, you know, it's all going to be okay. And it wasn't. We weren't happy about it at all, but it had, I suppose, looking back on it, that raw energy, the new wave of British heavy metal, half punk, half heavy metal kind of energy to it. And I think that's what people dug about the record, and that's why people bought it.
The album did pretty well, as you say, and you toured off the back of it, but then shortly afterwards you lost Alan Marsh, the vocalist, didn't you?
Basically, the record company just felt that he wasn't the right man for the band, and we did try to fight it, but Alan, for one thing, Alan was obviously quite hurt at what, you know, at some of the you know, things that they had to say, and I can't blame him for that, and it ended up with Alan saying, you know, I'll stuff it, I'm through with it, you know. And that was that. Now, the next thing, the next part of the story is, it hasn't very often been told. It's absolutely 100% true. We had a tour booked to support an Irish band called Mama's Boys. And it was a fairly big tour. For us, it was a big deal. And it was really moving up. They were playing sort of 2,000 or 3,000 seater venues every night. So this was big news for us, you know. But we had no singer. I mean, where do you go? All you could afford is a little ad in Melody Maker, you know. Established band need a singer, which is what we did, and we got sent so many tapes, and it was getting closer and closer and closer. Eventually we found out, one of the tapes that came in was from a guy called Vic Wright. To be honest, it was the only tape really that we'd been sent with any promise, you know. It was the only tape that we had with the guy could actually sing, and we felt that he was probably, you know, right for the band. He came down to Salisbury. He was from Bradford. He came down from Salisbury the night we were leaving for the tour, having never heard any of our stuff. And he turned up at, by the time he got from the train station to there, it was about 8:30. He walked in. One of the lads made him a cup of coffee. I sat him down in a chair, gave him my Walkman and all the lyrics, which I'd written out, and said, you've got till tomorrow night to learn them. And then about midnight, I think, we left. He sat in the van with the Walkman again and the lyrics and a little torch. And we drove to Dover, ferry across to Calais. Then things got really interesting. We were doing this tour on a shoestring. We had no money at all, as usual. Nothing. And our manager, we said to the manager, you know, how are we going to survive? How are we going to eat? He said, right, you've got a box of T-shirts here. Well, you had some T-shirts printed, real cheap. And he said, that's your money. That's your money for everything. That's your money for your diesel, for your food, for everything. You know, you sell them and you live. And if you don't, you don't. We got to France. We went through customs. We then drove away from the port and pulled into the first petrol station to fill up with diesel. Two police cars screamed to a halt behind us, or customs, confiscated our passports, ordered us back to the port. We went back to the port. They took everything out of the van, found the T-shirts, confiscated them, because in those days, of course, we would have been selling merchandise in France, and there was no EEC, so we were liable for the tax on that. So we had to pay a fine and hand over all the T-shirts. So the fine took care of every penny that we had, and the T-shirts took care of the T-shirts. So we were now in France, supporting a band with no money at all, not a bean, nothing. None of us had any money. No such thing as credit cards or anything like that. We didn't have them. And we got paid a little amount from each gig, which kept the diesel in the van. And for food, initially, we stole it. Our tour manager would go to a shop and he would just walk through the shop and put whatever he could in his coat and come out the back. And we were living on bread and cheese and all the strangest combinations of meals, because it was whatever he could fit in his coat. So we were, you know, some days we'd be eating sort of strawberries and bread, and then the next day we'd be eating, I don't know, you know, cranberries and socks and whatever, you know, whatever he could find. To me, Tokyo Blade and bands like Tokyo Blade, we represent the underdog. We're the downtrodden and the kicked and the, you know, the working class. And what the fuck else am I going to do? You know, I was, you know, I didn't get to Cambridge quite, so, you know, there's nothing there. I don't know anybody that owns any multinational companies that's going to give me a sort of chairmanship or anything. So it's a case of carrying on doing what you're doing. And we do what we're doing because, first and foremost, we believe in what we do. If people don't like it, that's their problem. If people like it, great. We're happier still. And if you, let's be honest, if you can do what you do and enjoy it, I would rather scrape a living out of what I enjoy doing than work in some awful place where I spent half my life hating doing what I was doing. So for me, it's still a good job.
Can you see areas of that early period where crap happened to you that didn't happen to other bands, and they perhaps skipped across the stones, whereas you ended up going between them?
Very much so. Metallica being the case in point, I would say. We played with Metallica an awful lot, and we knew them, you know, we knew the guys personally. And for instance, Lars and James Hetfield would often stay at Andy's, our bass player's, house when they came across to London. They would stay there and we'd go out drinking together. And we were playing with them on the same festivals. There was no, it wasn't like, oh, we're playing with Metallica, because Metallica were the same level as us. But Metallica, what can I say? They had the right management. Being American, I think, helps, or helped then. More resources and more money. You know, for instance, I mean, these garage bands. We, you know, they start off in mum and dad's garage. Oh, if only, you know, if only. I mean, we lived in a council house. We didn't have a garage anyway. And if we had done, you know, the last thing the neighbours would have wanted would have been us in there. So just even from a rehearsal point of view, everything was a struggle. You know, we had to find a hall, and then you hoik all the gear down there, and then you start practicing, and then somebody from the village knocks on the door and says, "Do you know that my wife is trying to..." And then it's, you know, I'll get out of there and find another hall. And so it goes on. And even from that point of view, they had, you know, they had a garage to rehearse in. Wonderful, their own garage, you know, and they could rehearse there when they wanted. Leave their gear set up. Fantastic.
So as we sit here now, you've just spent a week down at Chris's studio in Dover with the guys. What was it like back in the studio with the old troupe again?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Mental. Mental as ever. Childish, immature, all the things you love, all the things that us guys love. Childish, stupid, ridiculous. But what a time. What a laugh. I mean, you know, I was teaching at Winchester College, which is a very prestigious place to teach. I'm surprised they even let me in through the front door. You know, very respectable job, and, you know, a decent, you know, little house and a little car, and, you know, sort of, well, that's it now, you know, just keep trooping away now till I retire, and that's it. And then the next thing, you're back with these guys that you haven't seen for 25 years, arsing around, just exactly the same. Nothing's changed. None of them have changed. It's exactly the same as it was. It's just like turning the clock back. Everybody's just as immature, just as stupid, just as many stupid practical jokes and bad cooking and farting and the whole horrible thing, you know, and drinking. And the only difference is that now, you know, we get to about 10 o'clock at night and we're all going, I think it's home for bed, you know, whereas we used to be sort of 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning before we even thought about that. So that's changed.
God bless Tokyo Blade and every band like them is what I say. Do what you love and damn everyone else. That's got to be the way. Time now for the fruits of Blade's considerable labour with an exclusive preview of the new album, which is called 1,000 Men Strong. It'll be released in March. The track we have is called Lunch Case, a cheery tale of a serial killer who eats his victims.
We believe.
Now, Motorhead's new album, The World Is Yours, is available on a DVD and CD pack this month. There's also a vinyl version available. Also a vinyl version of Tank's new album, War Machine, which we covered in a previous issue. Magnum's The Visitation is out in February. We covered that in last month's show. Christian rockers Stryper, remember them? Have a covers album out called The Covering. Clever, you see what they did then? Features songs by Sabbath, Kansas, Cinderella and Mr. Big, amongst others. The Mighty Black Spiders, new to the area, but we covered them in our first show. Fantastic band, finally have their debut album out, Sons of the North. It's a cracker, we've already got it here. Bow Wow, who we covered as Vow Wow after they changed their name in the last show. There are four ultra rare early releases from when they started out, which have now been made available digitally. Details of those in our show notes. And there's a Jeff Beck DVD out through Eagle Rock. It's called Rock and Roll Party, honouring Les Paul, and features Imelda May on vocals and other special guests. Dave Rock Feinstein was an original member of Elf, fronts the New York band The Rods, and was also Ronnie James Dio's cousin. He recently released an excellent solo album called Bitten by the Beast, which included one of the last songs ever recorded by his cousin, Metal Will Never Die. Dave was good enough to tell us how it all came about.
Ronnie and I had seen each other in the last, 8 or 10 years. You know, we would see each other not a whole lot because, you know, we lived far apart. One of the times I had a phone call and he said, you know, I'm coming up. I'm going to be there for a few days. He said it would be a perfect time. He said I could sing a couple songs, you know, and I said, that's great. You know, so at the time, Carl and I were putting together material for a new Rods album. And coincidentally, I had just written the song Metal Will Never Die like a day before Ronnie called me.
Really?
Yeah. And it was weird because, you know, when I write a song, I usually, you know, I get an idea for a riff and I fool around with it for a few days and, you know, I might get a concept or a lyric or a title or something. You know, it doesn't come together instantaneously. Like, Metal Will Never Die came together to me, like, instantaneously. I sat down one day and wrote the whole song. We both looked at each other and I said, Carl, this has got to be one of the songs that Ronnie sings. He came to the studio and we basically put this CD of songs that he had never even heard before in his life, you know, in this boom box, and we played these, and he listened to the song for, you know, a few minutes, and he went in there and sang like a world-class performance on these songs, like he usually does, which was unbelievable. And I knew that's the way Ronnie worked because I'd worked with Ronnie before, you know. It's probably the most important song that I've ever written, and it will always be to me the most important song because, you know, Ronnie and I actually got to do something together again because we've talked about for years. And now the song becomes part of his legacy, you know, a tribute to him. And it just means an awful lot to me.
Make you hard. possess you. Shout it out with a voice from hell. I am metal and I'll never die. We are metal and we'll never die. I will crank you up. You can't bring me down. I will make you high. Metal will never die.
That's your lot for this month. Do join us again on March the 7th for the next show, when we'll be talking to Zodiac Mindwarp, Dio's guitarist Craig Goldie, Praying Mantis and the Australian Pink Floyd. Full details of this show, including everything we played, of course, can be found in our show notes at classicrockpodcast.com. Do please get in touch if you feel the need by emailing to news@classicrockpodcast.com. We'd be thrilled to hear from you. We're also on MySpace and Twitter, links to both on the homepage. There's just time to remind you that touring the UK in February are Rob Zombie, Black Label Society featuring Ozzy's former guitarist Zach Wilde, and Adler's Appetite, the new band from original Guns N' Roses drummer Steven Adler. If you're in the US, don't forget Ozzy and Slash are still touring this month, you lucky dogs. Get yourselves to one of those shows. Until next time, thanks for listening. Have a good month.